This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Listen, if I haven't heard that show before, I want to listen today. Welcome. We're on all the time, any time that you listen on the Star Worldwide Networks. The new shows begin at Sunday, 8 a.m., and that's just enough time for you to call your friends and tell them that we're talking about man's humanity spiritually to one another, and sometimes the lack of humanity. We'll be discussing a kind of broad-ranging subject every week. Why is God a he? Why not a she? Or why not the Force? Or perhaps all of them, huh? Because God show, well, it isn't a religious show at all. Sometimes we talk about specific religions, but when we do, we won't just talk about how splendid they are. Sometimes we'll just simply talk about what they are and why it is that you should listen more closely to the God show every time you tune in. A guest that now is making a return appearance, but a return appearance to the God Show on this address, that is the Star Worldwide Networks, the other address where we used to hang out for 16 or 17 years, KTAR Radio in Phoenix, was also kind of one of the headquarters for Dr. Zudi Jasser. And Dr. Jasser, this time, instead of just being another one of those broadcast talking heads, I'm going to let you do your own biography, starting with where you were born.
I was born in Canton, Ohio. My family escaped Syria in the mid-60s. I was born 3 months after they got here. They were waiting for congressional approval from their local congressperson to give them help in getting asylum. My dad was an intern at a small hospital in Ohio. Then he did his move to New Orleans, did his training in Louisiana at Tulane. Ultimately, I grew up in Wisconsin. That's where my memories really start when I was four. Went to the Navy on a medical school scholarship and served 11 years, and then came to Phoenix and have been since living here for almost 19 years now. Joined my dad in practice for about 7-8 years while he was alive, and have since been the president of the State Medical Society. And you've gotten to know me after 9/11 because I now I'm president and chair of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy.
Is that forum one that came about as a result of 9/11, or was it in existence before? You've been a practicing, as your family has been, practicing member of Islam all your life.
Yeah, I think my the best way to answer that is my reform efforts and my activism for modernity within the Muslim community has been going on since I was in college. And I talk about that at the on my book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam. But our organization, we founded after 9/11 because we realized that the vast majority of Muslims are part of the Islamist network, and they really are in denial about the primary problems. So,
now, wait, you said the vast majority?
Yeah.
The vast majority sees their religion differently than you do?
Yeah, they see it as a political entity. They see it as an Islamic state. If you look at every Muslim majority country on the planet, they're all Islamic states of some kind. They really are not secular democracies. Some of them are secular dictatorships, but they haven't gone through an American revolution where they have fought against organized theocracy. And because many of the failed states in the Middle East and the Muslim world are military dictatorships, they've seen secularism as a failure. So their response to secularism is theocracy, is a Islamic democracy, which I believe is still very problematic and an anathema to what American ideals are about.
How do they see you?
They see me as it depends on who the they is. I think since after 9/11, the majority of Muslims that are not active in Muslim organizations see us as a refreshing organization that is pro-American, pro-liberalism, pro-freedom and democracy, against theocracy, believe in reform. We own up to the fact that terrorism is not simply a symptom, but a defining element of an internal cancer that needs to be treated. Now, the Islamists who are running, you know, the political Islamists, and again, I don't want people to conflate political Islam with terrorism. Terrorism is simply one little narrow tactic, a militant tactic of sort of an Islamic State ideology. So most of the Islamists in America are nonviolent. They're against Al-Qaeda. They're against, you know, ISIS and all these other radical groups. But they don't really believe in a secular constitution. They believe that the Quran should be the constitution and the state's flag and identity should be an Islamic state. So those folks see me as the devil. They see me as, you know, some as part of some conspiracy theory against Islam, because in their fossilized mindset, you can't separate. Anyone who tries to separate state and mosque must be an enemy of Islam.
As a traitor to that cause,
yes,
that Islamist cause, have you ever been threatened?
Well, I'm not a traitor because I never believed in it, but I see what you mean. I'm a enemy
to
of
them,
that cause. I'm an enemy
them,
of
you
them.
Are also a traitor, are you not?
They see me as the Arabic term in the Quran is the word munafiqin, and munafiq in Arabic means hypocrite. And there were spies that used to come and pray, pretend to be Muslims. Our mosque here in Scottsdale, in 2014, there was a sermon that the imam gave there that I was taping and outed, and we talked about on our website, in which he said, there's folks here in town, a doctor that says he's Muslim and yet says things that are anti-Islam all the time. And this is not an uneducated guy. This is an attorney. And pretty successful, who basically said that, you know, Muslims that pretend to be Muslim are not necessarily Muslim if they are against the community. So they view anyone who's against the idea of the Islamic State as being against Islam and being a hypocrite and a spy within.
How many, at last count, how many Muslims in the world, of every faction, every belief, no matter how extreme, how moderate.
Yeah, so out of 7 billion people on the planet, 1.6, 1.7 billion are Muslim.
1.6, 1.7 billion. Approximately the same number of Catholics. We're talking about these two huge, enormous spiritual entities. But there are millions of Jews and millions of Buddhists. So why do you think so many think of Islam as the non-Christian enemy?
Well, because I think they're seeing who's attacking us. 9/11 was done by Al-Qaeda, who attacked us simply because they were afraid of Western influence, liberal influence on us. They're seeing the attacks on churches in Egypt, the inability to build anything non-Muslim in Saudi Arabia. The treatment of Baha'i, of anyone non-Muslim, people who leave their faith in Iran, in the Pakistani Islamic Republic. So you've got countries of hundreds of millions of people. I mean, look at Egypt after the Muslim Brotherhood ran that country for 18 months. Afterwards, and this is why I'm in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood being designated a terror organization, the Muslim Brotherhood worked with many radical groups, including themselves, to bomb churches, to make it uncomfortable for the Coptic Christians in Egypt, who are 10% of the population in Egypt, to be able to worship. So luckily and thankfully, they're not running the government anymore. But ultimately, you know, there are Christians that see this and say, well, what are Muslims doing to fix this? And just like you may say, well, in the 30s and 40s, not all Germans were Nazis. The Nazis were a minority. But what were the silent majority of Germans doing against Hitler? It took foreign intervention to get rid of Hitler. And I think similarly, the Muslim community has been silent. And we are not doing enough, especially in this laboratory of freedom. We're so worried about identity politics and the axis that is tipping in Washington left and right. We're not addressing the bigger problem, which is the freedom we have in America to do things you can't do anywhere else that can reform the ideas that shape our children.
I've mentioned to our God Show audience here, which is an international audience. People are listening to you in the Middle East and Europe and Asia, across the United States, as we broadcast this from our headquarters in Phoenix, Arizona. But I've kidded you in the past. I mentioned that you're making a return appearance here on – this location of the God Show, but you've appeared so many other times. And I've kidded you in the past because I've said, you know, Zudy, we're getting to the point where I'm getting sick and tired of listening to you because you are here as the voice of moderate Islam. You're here as the only voice that I can think of with all of the choices that we have of guests developed over the years. I can't think of another person who openly speaks out not only on the air but also to Congress about your position in the world of Islam.
Well, I think the reason that is, and it's becoming clear to me now, it's over 17 years that we've been doing this since 9/11. The issue is, and I don't use the term moderate, I use the term reformist, modernist, because I think the majority of Muslims reject terrorism, reject violence. But the issue is how many are willing to stick their neck out and take on the establishment. And I think this is where we have 15 Muslims right now that are leading different organizations in the West, in the Canada, in Europe, in the U.S., that are part of this reform movement. And I have to tell you, we get it from every side. We get it from, you know, and I don't want to label it left or right, but we get it from those who think, well, Muslims are peaceful, there is no problem. Or the other side that says, you know, Jasser's trying to put lipstick on a pig. There's no way to, you know, modernize Islam. It's stuck in the 7th century, and this is a fool's errand. And, you know, the bottom line is that we are willing and ready to debate these folks. I've debated imams here locally, and now they won't do it anymore because they, you know, always get exposed for how little they actually know about our religion. And, you know, ultimately, this is the hard work that needs to happen, that so many say, you know what, I'm living comfortably in a country that has the best constitution on the planet. I'm not worried about Islamists taking over the government. So why should I, you know, have my, you know, family given death threats? Why should I be attacked? I've got imams from Iran who are constantly trying to, you know, paint me into things that I'm not because we threaten the establishment.
You're highly respected as a physician and internist locally. You're highly respected nationally and internationally for your position and particularly your openness about explaining what your position is about Islam and why it is that we shouldn't make some of the generalities that those of us outside your faith seem to do. But after all this time knowing you, I rarely ever surprise you, but we have an additional guest today. Dr. Zudy Jasser is here on The God Show today to talk about the other Islam. But we thought that it would be an appropriate time for Muhammad to come in. And if Muhammad was here today, if he was our guest, you were talking about 700 years ago, what would he think of you?
Boy, that's a great question. You know, I think that he would respect the fact that, and I hope, and this is what, if you know, as my kids listen and read and look at what I do, I hope the legacy of what we're doing is that, you know, there's a saying in Arabic, which is Allahu Alam, which means God only knows the truth. And we do our best. And I think that Muhammad would be pleased to see somebody who loves his faith enough to be critical of our own community. And that's actually one of the sayings of the Prophet that he told Muslims, which is repair yourselves from within first before looking elsewhere. And I think to that tradition, Islam means submission. And the faith that he provided message of, I believe, was about submitting once you believe that you've done everything you can. You know, Islam doesn't mean peace. Salam means peace. Islam means you submit to God once you've done everything you can to be at peace with yourself. So I think the Prophet would be happy to see that there's somebody outside the clerical establishment who claims to be Islam, saying that it's not anyone's role to be God, tell other Muslims what is Sharia or not Sharia law, to organize us based on a state or an organization. And I think the Prophet would say, you know what, there might have been a system of politics and military for the 7th century, and I'm glad to see Muslims like Zudy and others around today to ask the question, not that what did I do, what did Muhammad do in 630 CE, but what would Muhammad do in the 21st century? That, Pat, is the question that's not being asked in hardly any mosque around the country.
Well, let me ask it here on this radio program. What would Muhammad, the prophet, do in this year, 2018?
I think he'd say, you know, we as a religion are 1,439 years old. Most major religions went through huge transformations at that age. And he would say, just as we use modern medical science, we use modern computer science, communication science, we use all the different things that are modern, why can't we use modern political science? And that Muslims should be humble enough to say, look, the Judeo-Christian world went through major changes and transformations and wars and learned from the fact that a society based in reason and a secular identity is far preferable to letting men in robes and beards run government and run society. So that has been the evolution of individual rights, of human rights, universally, all these things that before the Enlightenment and the Western revolution of individual freedom were looked at in a collectivist way. So I think the prophet would say, learn from your brothers and sisters here in the West that have gone through a modernization of thought, a rejection of tribalism and collectivism, and begin to apply your personal religion to arguing what you believe for publicly based in reason and not based in trying to ram your religion down other people's throats and trying to establish anything based in Islam. And I think he would ultimately say the central nugget of success for America is a country under God. So it's not rejecting God, it's rejecting a theocracy, but a country under God and a country with an establishment clause that the church can never, or the mosque can never, establish religion.
All right, you said God loves the truth.
Yeah.
What was that Arabic phrase?
Allahu alam, means only God knows what the truth, what the exactly correct thing is, or what will happen to us as a result of what we do while we're alive on this earth.
Is the truth in the Quran?
So as a faithful Muslim, I believe that the Arabic script of the Quran means recitation. So iqra means read. Quran is a recitation. So when God sent the angel Gabriel, we believe as Muslims, to Muhammad over, you know, many years, 23 years, to write down the Quranic script, we believe that to the comma, the Arabic script of the Quran is God's word and thus is perfect. But its interpretation, its implementation, its translation is all human. So anything you may read in English, any translation you may read or interpretation is human. But the God-given Arabic script of the Quran, we believe to be God's word and perfect.
Okay, what is the attraction? I'm going to ask you this in two parts. Part A, what is the attraction to Islam that creates such fervor in the hearts, not only terrorists, but also faithful believers who would be a part of no other faith?
So first of all, I think in fairness, I want to answer that question. I need to precede that by saying Muslim populations right now have some of the highest apostasy rates of any faith on the planet, in that they're leaving. In Iran, the highest number of new atheists leaving one of the three major religions is in Iran.
Because of the strictness of the faith?
Exactly, because the Muslims see Islam as being a black and white, inflexible, rigid set of laws that they want to leave, and they don't see that as God's religion, so they're leaving in droves. So the question that you're asking is, if it's the Islam of Al-Qaeda, of the Khomeinists, of the Saudis, of Wahhabis, of all these militants, most Muslims I know don't want that. If it's the Islam that I was taught and blessed to have learned from my grandparents and my parents and my family, the attraction, I think, is its decentralization. In many ways, we're more similar to Judaism than Christianity on that. There is no central authority in Islam. There's no confession, there's no baptism, there's no organized method of entering your faith. You can sit down and pray and supplicate to God at any moment of the day. That's what the five prayers a day is all about, is really just having a conversation with God, with his scripture, memorized scripture.
When I was in Israel, by the way, our guide said something that really surprised this American group that was traveling there, and that is how much more in common Judaism had with their friends across the border as members of the Muslim faith,
yeah,
because of the absolute monotheism and the things that you're talking about. I think that most of the group that he was talking to were Christians, and he was graciously saying, no, you're nice folks, but we have more in common with them.
So I have to tell you that there's so many conspiracy theories about why does Zudi work closely with the Jewish community and all that. Well, first of all, it's about being American. But secondly, there is a lot of similarity in that, you know, as far as the theology goes, Muslims reject the Trinity. We accept Jesus as a prophet. We look at our own scripture the way the Jews look at the Old Testament, and our legalisms, if you would, as they do the Talmud and Talmudic law. So there's a lot of similarities there. And the decentralization, the fact that a rabbi is simply a teacher, not an intermediary between you and God, as often the clergy and the Christian faith can be. But at the end of the day, we have a lot to learn, for example, from the Christian Reformation. If you look at Christian Reformation, it was all about the love of Jesus and the dispensing with all the hell and brimstone and all of that. Right now, gets back to your original question, which is, why are people becoming Muslim? Why would they want to?
Yes, why are they attracted to this faith?
When my family asked me, why do you do this every day, Zudi? This is, you know, you're taking on quite an undertaking. I tell them, you know, listen, there's a reason why the most violent day on the planet is Friday. If you look in statistically, the most violent day on the planet is Friday, because Muslims after Friday sermons leave so upset, dejected, victimized, calls for jihad. I can tell you statistically, when a quarter of the planet is listening to sermons that are often militant and grievance-centered rather than love, compassionate, humility-centered, you're going to end up with a lot of violence. So reform is not only about reinterpreting old scripture, but it's about coming to terms about what it means to be human. And what it means to be human is enjoying the gifts that God gave us and not just trying to blame others and complain and whine and look at the problems in the world, but why is the cup half full rather than it being always half empty for most Muslim populations?
Is that the essential problem that Islam has?
No, the essential problem that Islam has is not enough platforms for scholars to interpret scripture.
Oh, really?
To marginalize the black and white draconian clerics right now that dominate. If you were to Google any of the things I'm talking about, you know, people would say Jasser doesn't know what he's talking about, because the first 10,000 hits are that chapter 5 says kill the Jews where you find them, chapter 9 in the Quran says, you know, jihad is the only way, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, how do you respond to that?
I would tell them, well, here's other scholars, Fatima Marnisi, a known female scholar, Fazlur Rahman, Abdurrahim Wahid, scholars that Abdullah Naim from Emory. They're not going to be in your top 10,000 hits. They need larger platforms. They need movements. And that's what our American Islamic Forum is about, is trying to penetrate national, global, social media to begin to have. This is why it upsets me when folks on, you know, Twitter and Facebook are testifying about how they're suppressing certain political voices in America, when meanwhile Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood, have open Twitter accounts with little blue check marks that verifies how great they are, when in fact they are the ones suppressing most of the spread of the more normal 21st century ideas on the planet, because the West, through our technology, is ignoring the means that social media is being used to radicalize our communities.
What would you do about it?
I would actually work with our Muslim reform movement to help us get to Google, Facebook, and Twitter. Right now, Twitter said they employed some scholar out of the UK, and I can show you who she is. She is a apologist for sort of Islamist normalization, is not about reform and modernization. So I would tell you that if they're going to talk about these things in Congress, if we're going to talk about it in media, then we need to start to enable true reformers that take on, you know, right now, for example, if you look at, there was a USA Today report that looked at the top 17 Twitter accounts based on ideas. Do you know that three of them are Saudi radical imams? Three of them out of the 17 Twitter accounts on the planet are radical imams, and we hear about reform coming out of Saudi Arabia. That's baloney. You can't have reform when you have three accounts, each with 3-4 million followers at least. And meanwhile, folks like me are still, you know, sort of way on the bottom with 30, 40,000 followers.
At the beginning of this program, you lauded the Constitution, our Constitution, as being the best Constitution of any country that exists now or ever. Constitution says that all of those people are free to express their ideas. And are you saying they aren't?
No way. I don't want. Actually, I've testified to Congress that they should not have their voices suppressed. That's a good way to make them actually take off more. Turkey right now is suffering under an Islamist government because they tried to suppress these guys 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. But our voices, instead of simply dumping all of our tax money into counterterrorism and the whack-a-mole program, why don't we start a global pro-liberty program where we're using reinvoking the U.S. Information Agency, using the voice of America, El Hurra, to lift our voices up in major social media campaigns. So I'm not telling you to suppress their voices. Yes, if they're promoting violence like Hamas should not have a Twitter account. I'm sorry, they are terrorists. So terrorists who promote violence online should not be given the freedom to do that. That's not free speech. And our Supreme Court ruled against that many, many years ago. But why not? Why is the United States missing in action in the global war of ideas? Our government, I think, should weigh in and take sides.
How about if you started?
That's what we're doing. That's what I do every day, is take sides. And we submit for grants to government. We try to get them to take sides. But right now, it seems, I thought the Trump administration would be interested in beginning to promote voices of reform. I think Secretary Pompeo is on the right page on this. Absolutely. I mean, we worked with him when he was a congressman. Right now, the distractions are such that we don't seem to be making that much traction.
We're speaking to Dr. Zudi Jastrow. And by the way, wherever you are within the sound of my voice and his, maybe you'd like to jump on board. I don't know whether there's any such thing as an Islamic bandwagon. We hear about Islamic states. We hear about Islamic political movements and certainly Islamic terrorism. But if you'd like to get in touch with Dr. Jastrow and his organization, it's as simple as
AIFdemocracy.org. Our website is AIF, as in forum, democracy.org.
You and I have talked for years about this subject. Has anything really changed because of you?
Listen, you know, that's the question. You may think I'm not ready for that. Every night at the dinner table, almost once a week at least, I make sure I can answer that question because, you know, it's quite a personal investment we've done into this. And the answer to that question is yes. Look at the narrative. If you and I had had this conversation as we did in 04 and 05, nobody would know what Islamist was. Nobody would even heard really what's the Muslim Brotherhood. Why does that matter? Now, actually, the conversation, I think we have changed the national conversation. The national conversation used to be about terrorism, the war on terror, Al-Qaeda. Now the national conversation's about Muslims adapting to modernity, to free speech, to cartoons, to all the other aspects of things that I think are the base of reform. If you Google Muslim reform today and compare it to a Google search 5 years ago in the Wayback Machine, you will find our work and the 15 groups that we work with thousands and thousands of hits where they weren't before. And I think that's how you measure changes, what impact you're having on global conversations.
I love it when we can make history and make special inroads in the God Show. And we just did. I don't want to let you stop and think about where we were. I'll tell you where we were. We were at a special juncture in communication where a highly respected Muslim physician used as an example the Wayback Machine from Rocky and Bullwinkle. There is a God, ladies and gentlemen.
The Wayback Machine is the internet's memory. You can't delete things off the internet because you go to waybackmachine.org and you'll find it.
No, but I mean...
I don't know about your reference to Bullwinkle.
No, don't tell me that. I know how you spent your childhood. All I can tell you is...
I watched Bullwinkle.
I just thought, 70s. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And brilliant, creative, and clever.
Yes.
But away from cartoons for a moment. The problem that some people have, I think an awful lot of people, I may be among them, is the image, the individual image of the origin individual of Islam and the origin individual of Christianity. Jesus, even for those who are atheists, if they accept the reality that there was a person, in that period of time, a couple of thousand years ago, named Jesus, who spent a great deal of time in his 33 years preaching to people about peace. And he is always described as a peaceful, benevolent, gentle person. What I hear about Muhammad is, from the Quran, I am given to believe that he had elements of violence in his life philosophically. So the difference in those two individuals alone causes me a moment of pause.
Well, I don't think that the comparison as far as prophets go would be between Jesus and Muhammad. Jesus's ministry, I think, was all of 3 years.
And Muhammad's?
Muhammad's was 23 years. And I would compare him to Moses. Moses led a people. There were military engagements.
Muhammad was a military man.
Absolutely. So this is the problem, is that Muhammad was not only... Muhammad wore three major hats. One was as the one we remember him mainly for, is as messenger of God. He got God's message. But the other was as head of military, a general in the military, and also the head of state. So he ran a political state. So this is why you and I were talking before about, it's not... If you're only applying what Muhammad did in 620 CE, you could never separate mosque and state, because he wore all three hats. But I think if he were alive today, he'd say that that era has been proven to be no longer necessary. So the question is, I think, is the prophet, was he a moral human being? I served in the U.S. Navy, Pat, and I think that in the 21st century, the most moral fighting, and no offense to my British friends and others, but I do believe, and my Israeli friends, you know, I do believe the most moral fighting force on the planet is the U.S. military. And it's because they're God-fearing folks in that military. Are they perfect? No. We do immoral things here and there, just like any population has its corrupt criminals, as we do here. But the vast majority of everybody I served with in the U.S. Navy was moral. So if we had a general that said, go kill the Taliban where you find them, I think that would be a moral thing when we were engaged in a war in Afghanistan. Same thing in Iraq. If you say, go kill Al-Qaeda where you find them, that's a moral thing to say. It's an engagement of war that we were fighting. So if the prophet had passages in the Quran in which God gave him, after peace and other things failed, and gave him the sanction to be able to go fight a war, and said, go kill these folks in this battle, it doesn't mean it applies to all people of that faith for ad infinitum. It applies to that specific battle at that time, at that month and year.
What about the battle in Syria, your home country? Your parents came from Syria, and much of your country, with all of its history, looks now like rubble, just simply stone upon stone, as a result of fervent members of Islam bombing hospitals and orphanages, and they think that's morality.
Wow, you're getting me hot under the collar, because the ISIS tumor of the cancerous tumor of ISIS was an outgrowth of the Assad regime. Now, Assad is a Muslim that is tied to the Shia of the Khomeinists, the radicals of Iran, but he actually purports himself as being the protector of Christians, the secular controller of militant Islam in Syria. So a lot of the Russian and Iranian propaganda that was fed into the West was that somehow Assad was the bulwark of secularism against radical ISIS. And I wrote a piece for Georgetown Religious Center, Berkeley Center on Liberty, said that was titled "The Cauldron That Brewed ISIS." And the Assad regime's so-called secular cauldron, so-called secular country, is that cauldron that brewed them, which is sort of the nuclear political winter that was the fertile soil in which ISIS grew. So I would tell you that both pathways in the Middle East, the military, secular, vicious dictatorships of Hafez and Bashar Assad in Syria, or the Islamist radical theocrats of ISIS and the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia, or the Khomeinists of Iran, are two sides of the exact same coin, which is Assad pushes Arab nationalism, fascism, and ISIS pushes theocratic Islamism, which are both autocratic. So there needs to be a third pathway. And all I can tell you is, as we talk to our family that are suffering often from depression, from physical and mental injuries, that you have 10 million, half of their population is displaced in Syria. And 70% of the country has been devastated by just physical destruction of their structures. So all I can tell you is, I tell them, and it doesn't help me sitting in this beautiful country to tell them this, but at the end of the day, no democracy, no free society has ever sort of come from a ruler just handing over the keys to the kingdom to this people. That never happens. It has, all of our democracies in the West have come from major revolutions. And I hope and pray that Syria's revolution will ultimately end in a liberal society, which right now they're far, far from.
Hold on just a moment. I have a feeling that all the messages that we're getting telepathically from all around the world are essentially about one subject. I got to get in touch with my friends, my family. I've got to tell them what this guy is talking about, whether they agree with this guy or not. They want to listen because they haven't heard this message before. They haven't heard this side of Islam before. And it's one of the reasons why it is that I wanted to have Dr. Zuhdi Jasser back on this program, on The God Show, so that not only you could hear him, you in Peoria, you in Nova Scotia, and you in Damascus, because if you have electronic equipment that allows you to simply tune in to the Star Worldwide Networks, then you're listening to Dr. Zuhdi Jasser. In fact, you can listen to any of the shows every day, every hour at starworldwidenetworks.com. And you look under the worldwide channel for The God Show. And you can sign up on the landing page, too, under the RSS feed to get notified of new shows being broadcast weekly. But this one is going to be on forever and a day. Oh, you can also find it on iTunes. And I'm doing that for those of you who are saying, oh, but I'm missing this, or so-and-so isn't going to be able to. Yes, you're so-and-so, whomever that person is in your life, can listen to these thoughts. These thoughts from Dr. Zuhdi Jasser, these thoughts about progress that is considered to be major steps, Saudi Arabia allowing women to drive. That's front page news in a lot of places.
That's a bar that's so low that we should be embarrassed that that means anything about reform, okay? Please, I mean, it's amazing the bigotry of low expectations when it comes to talking about the Middle Eastern countries. Imagine if you told American women that, you know what, we believe in equality, we'll let you drive this week, but you can't go to work, you can't have property, you can't vote. And by the way, we're going to let you be on some councils, but it'll be some small little city councils in southern Saudi Arabia that don't matter, rather than anything in Riyadh or Jeddah or any of the major cities in Saudi Arabia.
But is it a step?
No, I think it's a facade. There have been more women, Pat, put in prison in the last 6 months than in the last 10 years. So he is buckling down on an authoritarian manner. And I disagree. I mean, President Trump, I get it, is doing the realpolitik right now as he tries to put back together a Middle East that President Obama fractionated as due to his Iranophilia. But, you know, at the end of the day, the greatest metaphor for what's happening in Saudi Arabia was they also had a WWE rumble in Riyadh, right? So here you have fake wrestling acknowledging fake modernization in Saudi Arabia. So reform will come. You know when it'll come? When the chief Supreme Court jurist in Saudi Arabia acknowledge the reforms that this prince is doing. Until you have jurists saying that here's the Islamic interpretation of why what he did makes sense, this is just Band-Aids to try to say, oh, look, this is window dressing for the West.
The only hesitancy that I ever have when I'm inviting you to a show like this is to hope for that day when you finally come out of your shell and really express your personal feelings about these subjects. Dr. Zuhdi Jasser, it's Zuhdi.
Follow me on Twitter, Dr. Zuhdi Jasser, Dr. Zuhdi Jasser.
Say it again, you said it too fast.
Dr. Zuhdi Jasser on Twitter, Dr. Zuhdi Jasser.
What country frightens you the most in the world?
Iran.
Why?
Now. I think now we're finally beginning to contain them again, but the bottom line is they could, you know, in a heartbeat, if they get nuclear weapons, they would turn suicide bombing into national suicide. I think ultimately they have been the fuel behind Assad's massacre in Syria. He would not be still there in power if it wasn't for Iran. So ultimately, when it comes to things happening in Yemen, throughout the region, the antagonism that Iran has had with Saudi Arabia has made the whole region unstable. So a lot of the instability has been due to that regime. I think ultimately the people in the streets that have been marching in the streets against the theocrats, saying death to the theocrats rather than death to America anymore in the last 6 months, I think has been the silver lining that may ultimately defuse that threat.
You've already said that you and the people who believe what you believe about your form of Islamic belief and faith and expression, that you are in the minority, that in your faith there are more people who are far more extreme in their beliefs than you are.
Well, hold on. Maybe I rushed through that. I'm in the minority of the Muslims. If you tried to get all the people you know here in Phoenix or across the country and let's list all the prominent Muslims that we know the names of, yes, I'm in that minority. Absolutely, we are a minority. But if you said, let's do a survey of Muslims living in America or living globally, the Islamists have yet to get a majority of vote. They get 20-30% of the vote in Egypt, but then they win in a runoff the second time against the military dictators. Same thing in Pakistan. You know, they just elected a cricket player who then ended up, once he got elected, even though he was not an Islamist before, became an Islamist so that he could appease the 30% voting block of the Islamists.
Very few people still internationally know about your organization, but everybody knows about ISIS. Everybody knows about Al-Qaeda. How can the extremists in your faith be controlled?
We need the Ariana Grandes of the world, who has 10, 20 million followers. After she gets attacked at her Dangerous Woman tour, and 100 people were, 200 were injured, 60 were killed, she needed to get on a platform on her social media and say, we are going to join Muslims in their war to protect women, to attack the radical ideas, etc. But instead, that opportunity was missed. So this is the issue, is we can't defeat the radicals just by trying to turn them off. We need to drown them out with platforms of voices of celebrities and others that can give rocket fuel to the ideas of our Muslim reform.
Well, who is as close to Ariana Grande as we can get that might possibly be a part of this movement?
We're working on that. We've been on Bill Maher's show a few times. I haven't, but a couple of the other, Ezra Nomani, Raheel Raza, who is part of our leadership group on the Muslim reform movement. But I don't know. That's a great question.
You've been working on it as long as I've known you.
I know. I don't know what it's going to take. It's going to take. I mean, we had Jay Leno, for example, who finally boycotted the Sultan of Brunei's investment in the Beverly Hills Hotel 5-6 years ago, and we thought, oh, maybe this will be the crack in the Islamist ceiling that's been preventing us from breaking through. And it wasn't. It was a short one-off boycott that they did of that hotel that is run by a country that treats women as fourth class. So this is the issue. When's Hollywood? When is the prominent social media class in the West going to get onto this civil rights. I think this is the civil rights battle of the 21st century, is the inside the mosques, inside the Muslim community, is the civil rights battle of the 21st century.
Women, fourth class in so many Muslim countries. So I'm assuming that if that's true there, and we have the kind of bias and strength over weakness and all of the things that we have in the United States that we're talking about right now in the United States, I'm assuming that women also are sexually assaulted in those countries too, without a voice. Is it possible that ever there could be, at least in your lifetime and mine, a Me Too movement in Syria, in Iran, in Iraq?
That would be the day that you'd start to see major, major change, is if you had, I mean, in India right now, India, people don't realize, even though Muslims are a minority there, India has 1 billion people, has 300 million Muslims. So it's the largest population of Muslims than any single country on the planet, even though Indonesia is the largest Muslim country by numbers. They just had, a month ago, they passed a law that there is a saying in Islam that supposedly a man can divorce his wife by saying, "I divorce you three times." The Indian government just outlawed that. That's the closest you're going to get to a Me Too movement, where finally the government said, listen, to this Muslim huge population, 300 million, you cannot divorce by verbal dismissal of a woman who has equal rights to her husband. It needs to be in court. It needs to be that she asks for it also, and not just the man. And there needs to be an adjudication of it. And it's not just what's called triple talaq or triple divorce. So that's one example. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, rape victims are considered the criminal because they were alone with that man. So the adjudication is that they shouldn't have been alone. That's why they couldn't drive, was because they were going to be alone with men. Even the Uber guy, David Plouffe, who's on the board of Uber, is setting up an app so that they can separate men and women when they get their Uber app out, so that a woman driver can pick them up with Uber. So here we are using Western technology to facilitate 13th century misogyny in the Middle East.
Rape laws in India among the Hindu population also were virtually non-existent until very recently.
Yes.
And then they began to really adjudicate these cases, and the rape victims were not necessarily the victims also of justice.
Exactly. And this is, you know, I think why we need these stories. I mean, you see them in the UK. There are so many Muslim organizations that are working for women's rights in Britain, because the populations percentage-wise are so much larger there. And the radicalization is not just militancy radicalization, but radicalization towards misogyny, domestic violence, and other things that can all be signs. If you look at many of the you know, Omar Mateen in Florida, who attacked the Pulse nightclub, he had history of domestic violence. The Boston bombers had history of domestic violence against women. Fort Hood had history of domestic violence. So a lot of these things travel together.
Some have said, and some have said passionately, that there is far too large a Muslim population in the UK.
You know, listen, I do believe that immigration should be ideological. I don't think, I'm not all in favor of open borders. I think America is an idea. My parents, as I told you, the first thing in the program, they waited 3 months. They thought they were going to get shipped back unless they got political asylum from their congress member in Ohio. So I believe there's some validity in us preserving what it means to be American. Now, having said that, folks that are here already, listen, we need to figure out a way to assimilate them and teach them what it means to be British, what it means to be American. We're not doing enough of that. And I can tell you, at our organization, we are working with vulnerable youth and creating programs on how to, you know, you think it's to sit with them and say, oh, this radicalism, that doesn't make sense. It's not just deprogramming them, but it's empowering them on how much America protects their Muslim identity. And that's a concept that, you know, we're not teaching our immigrants. We just sort of let them get vulnerable, you know, vulnerably attached to whatever victim grievance group there is. And ultimately, and this is why the saying for our Muslim Liberty Project is, we are American youth, American Muslims, Americans that happen to be Muslim, not Muslims who demand to be American. So if you come to this country and demand that you become an American, you're sort of losing what it means ideologically.
How old are your kids, Zudi?
They're 16, 14, and 10.
How old are you?
50. I'll be 51 in a few months.
When your kids are in their late 40s and early 50s, is their Muslim life going to be different than yours?
I can't pretend to. The answer is absolutely yes. I can't pretend to know what's going to be going on in 30 years. I do believe that whether it's through their apps or through their, you know, technology, I hope that it's not about being Muslim, but it's about God. I hope that they have a God-centered life. And Islam is just one of the vehicles to get there. One of the tenets of our reform movement is that we believe that we as Muslims don't have a monopoly or an exclusivity on heaven. That anyone who believes in God, ultimately, it's up to God. And like we said, Allahu Alam, only God knows what we do to achieve his truth.
But doesn't the Quran say that anyone who is a Muslim who converts to another religion should be punished / killed?
Punished by God. And it doesn't say another religion. It says anyone who leaves God and rejects God and becomes an atheist or a pagan.
Rejects Muhammad, rejects Quran.
You can reject, Muhammad's a human being. Yeah, rejects God's message. Yeah, there is a lot of threats in the Quran from God to those, you know, the lowest common denominator in society, if you will, those who leave the faith or reject his being and reject believing in his creation, in the creator. So, but that's about judgment day. And one of the things I tell my kids is, if you believe in a judgment day where God's going to weigh, just we believe in an angel that sits on each shoulder, a good one and a bad one, that write all the good and bad things that we do. If you believe in a judgment day, then you have to live in a society that allows you the freedom to sin. If you don't live in a society where you don't have the freedom to sin, then judgment day is absolutely meaningless. So yes, God is warning us in the Quran what will happen to those who reject him, but it's certainly not up to the government or any imam who, you know, there's the word warner is used frequently in the Quran. So if God was warning us in the Quran, it should be rather empowering governments to tell us what to do if that's really their role. It's not. He's simply warning us, and he's the one who's going to judge us.
Well, in all fairness, we should also acknowledge there are a lot of threats in the Bible, too.
Yeah. I mean, I'll leave others to their own religions to define, you know, some of the hell and brimstone in other scriptures.
How old is your daughter?
She's 14.
14 years old. Boy, yeah. You talk about an impressionable age. That's an extraordinary transition time, particularly for a young girl. I know she knows about the repression and oppression and suppression of women in those countries that represent her faith. What does she say about that at home? Anything?
You know, I think it's with the example my wife sets and, you know, the freedom, the leadership that she has. I think the role models that my daughter has in both of her grandmothers and what she sees, the Islam she knows, is one of equality. So it might as well be the other faiths that you know, I think she realizes that there are interpretations of Islam. I mean, she may see folks behaving at certain Islamic establishments or mosques that treat women differently. But at the end of the day, I think she realizes that she's taught by her family that it's about choice, it's about freedom, that she'll make her own decisions. And she has a personal relationship with God, and that is her Islam. That is Islam. It's how she defines it and practices it in her personal relationship with God.
Since I know about your frustration about the tortoise-like pace that you see and that you experience in the movement to your kind of Islam, I wonder if you could share with our audience, I've never asked you this, if you could share with our audience right now in so many different parts of the world what they can do. They're not Ariana Grande. They're not the heads of state. They're folks listening to the radio. And a lot of them are frustrated too. Some of them frustrated because of what you've said, because they haven't heard that message before. What can they do to make your position move a little faster?
Well, I want to use a metaphor. How many times do you see on the local news a video that they say, oh, this is the latest viral video of a policeman retiring who, after 30 years, gives a little speech from his little phone and it goes viral, or a blind football player playing at Brophy that all of a sudden now is viral across the planet. What did people do there? They took his video and put it online and told their friends, look at this. So there were 5,000, 6,000 people locally that put that online, and all of a sudden a million people saw that and loved it. So similarly, you've got Muslim people here locally that are activists, that are doing things that I think are an opportunity to lift up, be a part of the change that we are doing here that needs to be spread, and have conversations with your local mosque, with your neighbors, about what are they doing to, you know, we're working right now on bringing an imam, hopefully from the Middle East, to work with us here. To
live here?
If we can, we'll see. We're working on it.
We say here now. We're not talking about Indianapolis, so don't get excited.
No. In the U.S.
Phoenix, Arizona, and across the country.
Yeah, so you'd be surprised that actually the more reformist imams are from the Middle East, because they know what happens when the Islamists take over, et cetera, and they're not just sort of created out of the ideas here. So obviously, if you look at the Cold War, a lot of the think tanks that now are shaping the debates about the Supreme Court, about healthcare, are think tanks that Americans created during the Cold War. Whether it's the left Brookings or the right Heritage or AEI, American Enterprise Institute. So Americans, I think, need to say, okay, this is the second decade of the 21st century. What are we doing to leave a legacy that begins to empower that portion of the quarter of the world's population that's Muslim, that either is going to begin to, I mean, if you see what's happening in Turkey, Turkey's the new Saudi Arabia. And they are a member of NATO. And if you think Erdogan is going to leave Turkey's leadership quietly, you don't know what's going on. So at the end of the day, Americans locally, all politics is local. Engage your Muslim friends. Ask them what they're doing. Find interpretations of Islam and of strategic approach to foreign policy and national security policy that you agree with, and begin to have this conversation at every level. You'd be surprised how functional we can do it.
They might need some help. You ready?
Yes, we've been always ready. I've got my podcast, Reform This, on SoundCloud and on iTunes, so people can download it. It's released every Saturday at noon. And we have a reform report that comes out, so people can spread that. There's a lot of ways to engage us at AIFdemocracy.org.
Is that how we find you?
Yes, AIFdemocracy.org, or on Twitter at Dr. Zudi Jasser.
And of course, he's on a day in advance of me. That rascal, he's making some moves, isn't he?
The week starts on Sunday, though. I'm on the end of the week. You're at the beginning.
Have a little faith. Maybe new faith as a result of listening to what I've always enjoyed, and that is the brilliance, the gentility, and the wisdom of Dr. Zudi Jasser. And just think, that faith, and maybe a trace of hope, came as a result of you listening to The God Show.